Discontent in Politics, José Luis Pardo. Two phenomena have merged from the political turmoil installed in advanced democracies since the financial crisis of 2008. Firstly, the discontentment of a big part of the population severely affected by a worsened social environment, perfectly valid and comprehensible, and secondly, the transmutation of such discontentment into a political malaise, or to be more precise, the emergence of a clear discontent within politics itself. In this article, we will review the nature and origins of this latter phenomenon to discover it goes back before the crisis and finds its roots in an old bitter resentment towards social democracy, in its turn reawaken into a new form of discontent policies that dispute the legitimacy of the rule of law. Intro. The following reflections should be considered from a philosophical perspective. For better or worse, philosophy doesn't merely represent an immediate and abundant storehouse of solutions, but more like a particular system of thought procedures for posing, outlining, and defining problems in a conceptual manner. For the last 3 decades, I've been conducting research enclosing what I could currently describe as discontent or discomfort. Naturally, this is a very ambiguous term, unreservedly vague to envisage any definite concept. Nevertheless, it has been strategically chosen on account of 3 main reasons. Firstly, and probably the most obvious argument, is the negative reference to the political project generally known as the welfare state. Whichever the interpretation of discontent I am trying to diagnose, it is evident that it is controversially connected to the welfare state, and will therefore demand clarification of its present avatars. Secondly, the evocation of Freud's 1930 book Civilization and Its Discontents. It must be underlined that the parallelism here is only occasional. My field study does not involve psychoanalytical methodology. Therefore, my research is not focused in the anthropological sense Freud gives to the term Coulter, but rather the cultural sphere in industrial and post-industrial societies where political turmoil is transformed into a culture of discontent that particularly rejects the legacies of the Enlightenment meant to guide individuals through knowledge. The third reason is by far the most important of all. It aims to address the vagueness of the term's discomfort. From a nosographic point of view, it describes a slight uncomfortable pain that clinical medicine is unable to treat or cure, precisely because of the uncertainty of its causes and the variety of its symptoms. Modern medicine cannot confront a condition that doesn't seem to stem from any specific syndrome. In similar ways, social discomfort or discontent has become resistant to the core institutions of the welfare state that should channel political conflicts, among other things, because it is found within those same institutions. Therefore, social discontents consolidated by policies of discomfort have transformed the public sphere. This transfer of responsibility towards the politicians and the resulting sensation of innocence in the people that voted for them in the cause of an understandable frustration that leads to social division. The obvious and the non-obvious of the current discontent. There is a type of discontent that will not be referred to here. The irritation of populations that have become impoverished, factually or legally, due to successive budgetary adjustments through which some of the most advanced democracies have tried to cut the accumulating public debt. The 2008 public debt crisis was frequently intensified by the political corruption scandals that have come to light during the same period of time. The uneasy feeling showed towards the immorality of politicians, injustice, poverty, or inequality is nothing but a perfectly natural reaction, one that could even be considered socially healthy. Therefore, we see the need to reflect on the evolution of this social dissatisfaction into political discontent, or rather, the discontent with and in politics. There is a leap which is neither obvious nor immediate in, let us say it with this image, feeling indignation toward the decline in social conditions, versus being ready to vote for a xenophobic political party or to one that questions the legal framework of representative democracy. This leap is precisely what I have decided to analyze. It is understandable that, before the situation triggered by the financial crisis, certain organizations were ready to capitalize on, politically speaking, that discontent. On many occasions, these organizations described themselves as instrumental, meaning they did not have a determinable philosophy of their own in the already known ideological spectrum, or, if they had it, they were ready to shelve it, and that they offered themselves obligingly to the people as more or less neutral instruments, not left-wing nor right-wing in the usual sense, to politically assemble that discontent. They have generally been instrumental in an even more aggressive manner by trying to exploit discontent for electoral gain. It is worth noting that these organizations would have not reached their current level of success if their ideas had not permeated through a part of the population. The current political parties, in some cases consisting of a century of tradition, were incapable of offering solutions for this discontent. This idea is far from spontaneous because it is precisely the centre-left and the centre-right parties who built the welfare state. If these welfare parties appeared soon, in the eyes of many voters as residues of old politics that had to be overtaken, and if it was against these parties that these voters pronounced the slogan, "They do not represent us," it was not because they had failed to fulfill the rules of the representative democracy, because of course they were to this end their legal representatives, as they had been for many years. It was because the supposedly instrumental and neutral organizations, the discontent parties, had a very well-defined ideology, at least in its negative dimension, namely that the center-left and center-right parties that had taken turns in the government since World War II, or in Spain since the restoration of democracy in 1978, were precisely the culprits responsible for this discontent. This ideology was not proposed to subjects of a dictatorship or to the victims of a tyrannical government, but to citizens of the world's most established democracies. By accepting this narrative, citizens were responsible for keeping the guilty ones in power by giving them their vote. And consequently, they would also have to accept some responsibility for their own discontent. Acceptance of this kind would have been very unpopular, and it would have hardly reached a relevant impact. How could it be possible, then, that a sector of the population, let us suppose we are talking about the people that have seen their jobs, their economic conditions, and their prospects worsen, gets to blame the political parties they have supported for decades, without accepting any responsibility for this decline? To go from "I am not doing well," or "I am worse," to "politics are guilty for my discontent," needs a middle ground, that is, the breaking of the representational link between citizens and elected officials, symbolized in the propaganda field by the aforementioned "they do not represent us." In other words, this transfer of responsibility towards the politicians and the resulting sensation of innocence in the people that voted for them, in the cause of an understandable frustration that leads to social division. Additionally, a part of the electorate that was until recently their supporters are now their opponents, that consider the public agents not as representatives of the voters, but as their predators, as the instruments of a privileged Soblick office, or by the irregular financing of political parties as it points to suspicion, essentially towards representative democracy. It implies it implicitly because it presupposes that these institutions have been, for more than half a century, a simple disguise for the domination of the privileged over the rest. Furthermore, the economic crisis would only have uncovered its grimmest facet, a domination that would have been exerted through means that outpace the legal and institutional controls of the parliamentary democracies, and that, therefore, could only be fought through means that also go beyond this political framework, hence the need for new politics. Needless to say that, clearly, the success of such an implausible account, in the case of Spain, it entails accepting an objective political continuum between Francoism and the regime of 1978, would have been impossible without this other contributing factor. The clumsiness, or maybe the excess of craftiness and tactics, of the political parties that I have called the welfare parties. This foundational negligence, which was being used to take turns in holding on to power with little effort and even less discourse, had become, little by little, and to a large extent, electoral machinery. These machinery, when threatened by an unexpected rival, reacted too little and too late, underestimating scornfully their rivals in the first place, and trying later to imitate their slogans to stem the leak of supporters, which increased, ironically, the support and credibility of the political parties of the discontent. As a consequence of all this turmoil, we tend to lean towards certain anthropological pessimism. The fact that today we speak of political disaffection seems to presuppose that, before the financial crisis, citizens seemed interested in participating in political debates. But when we see how quickly the apparent confidence in social democracy based on the rule of law has become a detestation of the political leaders, does this not incite us to think how much patronage there was in this presumed confidence? It would be an error to think that this discontent is a radically new phenomenon and that it is exclusively related to the recent financial crisis. Its roots are much deeper and its history much older. Social agreement and modern politics. Although we frequently tend to forget the origin of states based on the rule of law, a rule of law that still confers meaning to our actual understanding of politics goes back to the 17th century as the result of endless religious wars which devastated Europe for more than 100 years. In order to put an end to a dreadful situation, an unprecedented political legitimacy, the so-called social contract, was established to pacify identity conflicts and to settle a new frame of cohabitation that would strengthen the forthcoming liberal revolutions. The original position of the social contract, that contains the legal grounds of the liberal state as a form of social organization, posit free individuals, liberated from any previous attachment, family, social, military, religious, cultural, ethnic, hierarchic, or of loyalty, that have consented to meet in an assembly to agree under equal conditions and without any external coercion the rule of law according to which they accept to live together in exchange for protection of their rights. In this setting, Hobbes, so to speak, placed at the beginning, as if it was an existing reality, what could only be at the end, if society has success, and this being its most exquisite achievement, a group of individuals. It could not be any other way because, as we have already said, it was about, in the Europe of the 16th and 17th centuries, reaching the peace treaty that would put an end to the devastating and hateful religious wars that seemed endless, precisely because they stemmed from the irreducibility of the antagonistic cultural identities that condemned them to resolve their superiority in the battlefield. The social agreement demands, as a precondition for cohabitation, that only after having been signed, individuals can acquire a certain identity, family men, firemen, Bretons, Protestants, priests, or soldiers, based on the understanding that it is compatible with the private identity of each of the remaining signatories. This is the reason why public law is always the precondition and the foundation of private law. It has always been known that this setting is a fiction and that it does not match any empirical reality. But it has also been known that the political legitimacy of the state, based on the rule of law and of the laws that derive from it, can only be thought of as if fiction would have been and still is a fact granting legal reality to what lacks material reality, and hence using that ideal model as the aim towards which legislation should tend. The concept of identity ended up replacing that of social class. Hobbes knew that in real societies, individuals came from a certain identity, at least that of the lineage community that they belonged to, but he subjected those communities to the jurisdiction of a society that makes their members free enough to judge independently of their identity and therefore of their prejudices. The same objectivity is demanded nowadays to a citizen that is a member of a jury, a representative of the parliament, or a judge that presides over a court. That is, the ability to place public interest over private interests, related either to their community or their identity. And that is what the educational institutions of the Enlightenment have always professed. Those individuals, once in the limits of the institutions, can get rid of their identity and community's characteristics, not to betray or eliminate them, but to relativize them, in order to rise to a virtually universal level in which arts, science, and philosophy are to be found, as they happen to be disciplines that demand universality and refuse to accept excludable communities, where they will be able to empathize with any other individual when it comes to judge, legislate, or rule. During the 19th century, the liberal societies experienced several forms of discontent and received very articulated and well-deserved criticisms from, or in the name of, those deprived of civil rights and liberties that should constitute citizenship. Some of them were deprived de jure, regardless of their financial condition, just because they belonged to stigmatized groups, that is, they could not free themselves from their identity and, therefore, sign the agreement. Others owed this exclusion to their material poverty that prevented them de facto from exercising these rights. We must say of both that they had good reasons to feel discontentment towards the rule of law, which was not such for them, and that they reclaimed their nature as citizens with full rights. Their claims were, therefore, totally integrated in the frame of the principle that law should govern a nation, and their discontent was the type of discontent that we previously said couldn't be questioned because it was already fully justified. It took its time for the complaints regarding this flagrant inequality to make its way. Although it is somehow obvious that the exercising of the civil rights is impossible in practice for those who lack all material welfare or the legal status of individuals, this circumstance goes unnoticed for those that already enjoy both things and that, therefore, tend to think of civil rights and, likewise, of their absence as something relatively natural, blaming the nature of the workers, women, or colonized populations for their lack of material resources or public liberties. What the labor movement laid on the table was the evidence that a society that grants civil rights to all of its members but denies some of them the material resources that would allow them to exercise them cannot be considered fully democratic. But it would not have been possible to interpret the labor movement of the 19th century as a political movement if it had had material welfare as its only goal. It had political relevance because the aspiration for social rights was a mean to reach higher purposes, the full acquisition of civil rights and public liberties. What is the welfare state? Regardless of how we define it, it is clear that what we call welfare state is in turn the result of this double deficit of the state based on the rule of law that was incapable of managing the identity tensions emblazoned as nationalism and the social tensions shown by the labour movement. Consequently, the state had to witness the enormous disasters of the two world wars and all of their sequels. Due to this turn of events after World War I, many politicians, intellectuals, jurists, philosophers, and mere citizens experience specifically political discontent against states based on the rule of law. They were convinced that this institution had been overwhelmed by unprecedented circumstances and that it had to be replaced by a new type of state in which many laid their hopes. But after World War II, it was dramatically clear that these new states were nothing more than totalitarian fascist states that were defeated during the war and communist states that survived it. Since the coming of the Russian Revolution, the communist states had erected a universally material welfare coverage project. However, they denied their subjects the civil rights of representative democracies, which they considered a simple makeup for exploitation, so they never granted them even though they had enough material welfare to exert them. In fact, from communism's ideological orbit, fascism was considered the contemporary form adopted by capitalism once it ended its bourgeois stage, i.e. Seville, in which public rights and liberties would still have been a facade that tried to hide the class domination, whilst fascism would have eliminated the facade for keeping only sheer domination. Hence, communism appeared for its supporters as the only force able to confront this domination with its own weapons, that is, from the perspective of the improvement of the state based on the rule of law, and likewise, fascism became ideologically legitimated as the only force capable of stopping communism and justified in this way its authoritarian structures. In this sense, fascism and communism were already mutually part, and despite their antagonism of that new post-bourgeois world, in which so many believed before starting to use the term totalitarianism. In 1945, the state of discontent was viewed as a Cold War between the totalitarian states gathered around the USSR that rejected parliamentary democracy and states based on the rule of law that presented themselves as socialist states and liberal democracies that had kept its institutions alive, but that were by then tragically conscious of their social and political deficits. And it was the latter's that, in order to meet the huge challenge, signed new civil agreements symbolised by the consensus between the centre-left and centre-right parties around a political project that defended a state that had to be both social, as the fascist and communist states were in their own way, and based on the rule of law, as the modern parliamentary democracies had always been. This combination of juridical welfare civil rights and material welfare social rights is the so-called welfare state that had never been proposed so explicitly before, although it was implicitly inscribed in the social contract. It was probably John Rawls in the 20th century who analysed in more detail what I previously called the original position of the social contract. Rawls understood that the state based on the rule of law had no other alternative than to be thought not only as a pacifier of identity tensions, but as what we nowadays call social state. As legislators, the citizens have the legal power to endow public rights, but they cannot legislate on the amount of material welfare that shall belong to them, because it depends on circumstances that are not legally controllable, nor, therefore, foresee their private identity. And this means that, when establishing common law, they ignore their luck and the place they will hold in society because they do not know who they are or, in other words, who they are going to be, Rawls spoke of a veil of ignorance that prevents the contractors from having this knowledge. And it is because of this ignorance that, when legislating, they will do it, necessarily in such a way that those that are the unluckiest are not totally abandoned by their partners because any of them could be in the same situation in the future. And it is in this sense that it should be said that the liberal state has implicitly, and since its own creation, the need for democracy to be social, as well as juridical, despite the welfare state being the only entity which has set out this condition in a clearly obvious and manifest way. This being the state of things, the construction of a democracy that was social and based on the rule of law at the same time was an explicit and unprecedented programmatically experiment. World War II, with its devastating destruction and brutality, was the sinister setting in which this wager became necessary, because the state based on the rule of law itself, this is politics, as they had been developing since the 17th century, was risking its survival in the face of totalitarianism. Any social idea about welfare must refer, in the first place, to material welfare, that is, the coverage of the basic needs of life. With any type of doubt, any social idea about welfare must refer, in the first place, to material welfare, that is, the coverage of the basic needs of life and solving of human shortages, despite the notion of basic needs being always an object of debate. We can see that material welfare depends, on the one hand, on the production activity of individuals and, on the other hand, on the circumstances, never fully manageable, which are external to them. In this sense, no state can guarantee to all its members the right to be always well, but only, and that is what the welfare state is about, the right to be as well as the collective material conditions allows it in each and every moment. In other words, the state grants the right to expect a fair distribution of wealth and poverty in each historical situation. This is an important observation because in 1945, when the project of the welfare state appeared, specified in the advanced liberal democracies, Europe was economically destroyed by the war and there was not much wealth to share out. This is normally what we refer to when we talk about the acknowledgement by the state of social rights of the population or of social cohesion programs and the programs for fighting against financial inequalities, which are some of the distinguishing features of the welfare state. Nevertheless, the mention of law in previous paragraphs already tells us that welfare is not only material. Material welfare and the social rights that guarantee it is the condition for a superior type of welfare. Juridical welfare that entails the exercising of civil rights, that transform individuals into politically free citizens of legal age, responsible for their public life and masters of their private life. Material welfare is necessary because, up to where it is possible, it frees individuals from nature and external circumstances. Nevertheless, juridical welfare will only be satisfied if it guarantees that this material liberty will become political liberty, that is to say, the liberty to choose the public law that will allow one to live in peace with the rest of individuals, regardless their origin or social position, and the liberty for individuals to choose their own life paths. The origins of discontent. The citizens of the countries where the welfare project had started in 1945 supported with a large majority the moderate parties that backed it, which actually meant a new definition of the terms left and right in politics. Only those who took side with totalitarian political solutions, communists or fascists, were left out of this consensus. They were, electorally speaking, a minority, and therefore were rejected towards the ends of the political spectrum, and were almost always left outside from parliaments. But the fact that discontent within the welfare state was parliamentary invisible or comprised a minority does not mean that, from a general social viewpoint, it lacked importance. On the contrary, the extreme left, that is the name adopted then by those who defended the validity of the communist project as an improvement of the state, based on the rule of law and, by extension, of the welfare state, occupied the intellectual front with great success. No wonder. Kolakowski, the great historian of Marxism, stated that ideas are the respiratory system of communism and gave place to the so-called New Left, a merely rhetorical name because, in fact, it was in principle that old communist left that had been politically discarded by the victories of the welfare state. When talking about intellectual success, I am not only referring to the hegemonic communist ideology within the intellectuals in Europe between 1945 and 1980, and the resultant discredit of the writers that, like Berlin, Aron, Arendt, Koestler, and many others, were expelled from the field of legitimate ideas under the accusation of being reactionaries, but also, and above all, to the construction of the so-called cultural left. From positions of power at universities, in publishing houses, or on the art scene, the New Left produced a genuine culture of discontent within the welfare state, compensating its parliamentary irrelevance. That gave place, especially in France, to a series of leading figures that kept alive the myth of the moral superiority of the left, the authentic left that was certainly different to the one occupying its seats in parliaments. Based on its intellectual supremacy, ideas still were the respiratory system of leftism. From the moral and intellectual superiority which discarded parliamentary democracy as being an optical illusion, resuming in this way the traditional speech of the revolutionary communist parties, the cultural left adopted political models that were no longer historical heirs of the Russian Revolution, because they had lost, in their opinion, their revolutionary authenticity when agreeing on a Pax Oligofrenica with capitalism. However, the leaders of communist revolutions in the Third World questioned the international order of the Cold War. Without the implementation of the authentic left, that was not the real political left, in the cultural front, the first great explosion of discontent within the welfare state, that meant the events of May 68, events in France, preceded by Guy Debord's The Society of the Spectacle, because that was, for Debord, the welfare state, a spectacle that distracted people from their revolutionary destiny, would be inexplicable. Many thought that this explosion was unimaginable and unmotivated. What then was the reason for young students who had enjoyed liberty and materialistic conditions never before achieved to revile the European and North American democratic societies in the 1960s and idealize romantically those of other places in the world like Cuba or Vietnam where, to be honest, there was little welfare? They disdained what Foucault or Deleuze called macropolitics, those developed in parliaments, governments, and courts, and they promoted micropolitics of desire that, in the words of Guattari, announced a molecular revolution where the frame of the state was no longer a reference, because it was positioned beyond in a stage of international movements or near to it in what had, up to then, been called civil society. For all of them, the welfare state with its dense and powerful social assistance could be interpreted as a micropolitical, biopolitical, more specifically, controlled device against populations. And the discredit that this entailed for the concept of class that had been a fundamental reference for articulating the political speech of the left made its replacement emerge strongly, the concept of identity. This concept was not only valid for third world countries where it was impossible to talk about a proletarian or a working class, but was also used to designate new political agents accredited by the 68's events, the feminism difference, the LGBT movement, ethnic minorities, the psychiatrized, etc., whose claims, precisely because they did not demand an independent state, not even a party nor a union, did not fit well in the institutional fabric of the welfare state and defined a new territory of cultural fights. Populism is to politics what sensationalism is to journalism. Naturally, the criticisms towards the welfare state are legitimate and even essential in a political regime that, just like parliamentary democracy, makes criticism its fundamental device for rational deliberation. Without a doubt, during those years, there were many things open to criticism in national and international stages, starting with the Vietnam War. But the most remarkable aspect of this movement was that the political organizations that developed it, that were and still are politically marginalized, used the same militant rhetoric of war and considered the authentic political leaders to be Che Guevara or General Giap, whilst the presidents of the republics and the prime ministers of the liberal democracies were considered wimps of the great capital. In other words, criticism of the welfare state was not made in the name of a state based on the rule of law or social democracy, but precisely from a project consisting in overcoming those institutions that in the times of the world wars gave place to totalitarianisms. Certainly its geopolitical models were no longer the USSR and its satellites, but, as we have said, Castro's Cuba, Mao's China, or Ho Chi Minh's Vietnam. Although those regimes seemed then much more exotic, they were not less totalitarian as a result. A project that excluded every form of criticism within its own functioning, and where any anti-system movement like the one that took place in France in 1968 would have been literally impossible. The political goals of the 68 movements were far-fetched. The establishment in France of a Soviet government, the dissolution of the family, etc. And in this sense, they may have appeared as a tantrum without any political consequences. De Gaulle won the elections of June 1968, and so both the Communist and the Social parties lost deputies. But it wasn't the case because the cultural consequences were incalculable, starting with a rooted bitterness against the welfare state due to its social nature, in which the Foucaultians, as we have said, saw a clear attempt of biopolitical control of the populations. And although it is common to speak about the Cultural Revolution of 1968, the truth is that these movements, despite not achieving the revival of class conflict, are to be found at the base of the cultural wars that would end up taking shape by the late 20th century of the so-called identity policies. In spite of their emancipating orientation, these identity policies are already part of what we call the policies of the discontent, to the extent that in its most radical facet, despite not proposing any alternative model to the welfare state, they contribute to the systematic undermining of the central figure of the system erected in 1945 in advanced Western democracies, that of the autonomous citizen and subject of rights. If, at this point, we can talk of a discontent in the cultural sphere, it is necessary to mention a kind of resentment against the welfare state, which found refuge in the territory of culture, because those cultural wars which focused on identity soon went on to become hostility policies. That way, the concept of identity ended up replacing that of social class as target of the new conflict, because the identity, understood as political identity, is always antagonistic. It is based on the denial of the identity of the enemy, and it attacks the pillars of the state under the rule of law. From 1970 onwards, the criticism and the attacks against the welfare state came mainly from the right, although certain elements of this criticism became politically transversal, and part of the ideological language born in 1968 became generalized. It was from here that a new right, that is not that new, who had a higher profile in the media rather than a cultural one, was born, and it quickly set up, with a great electoral success, its own policies of discontent, discrimination, social hostility and division, in which the notion of identity also played a starring role. Because policies of discontent are all those that, in spite, as happened with the goals of May 1968 in France, of proposing positive, chimeric and extremist targets, the total closure of the national borders or their total elimination, for example, tend to divide society into friends and enemies, mining the pre-political consensus that supports the civil agreement. During that same decade, the businessman and economist John Harsanyi submitted Rawls' assumption mentioned before to criticism regarding the implicitly social nature of the civil agreement that supports the state based on the rule of law. This theorist held that, from the rational decision point of view, the gamble of the signatories of the social contract that legislate thinking that they may have the worst of luck and hence promote a social state based on the rule of law is too conservative because, if they accepted higher risks, this is, if they cease putting themselves in the place of the most disadvantaged, they could obtain greater benefits. From an apparently antagonistic position, this argument does not only express its discontent with and in the welfare state, criticizing its condescendence towards the less fortunate, but it directs its attack towards the same goal, the public welfare policies. If the New Left, reviving the Marxist philosophy of the ideological fight, saw in this group a biopolitical control apparatus of the dominant classes over the people, Althusser, for instance, considered public education one of the main ideological apparatus of the bourgeois state. The New Right, also recycling populist arguments from the 1930s, identifies them with overspending, corruption, and social parasitism. The sociologist Richard Sennett, at the end of his book Respect in a World of Inequality, shows us an image that could serve as a symbol of the Last Supper, of the welfare state, or even better, of the first of the state of discontent. Let us imagine a group of friends, colleagues, or neighbours that gather once a year at a restaurant for dinner. As time has gone by, they have established a habit. When supper is over, they share the bill, each contributing with the same amount. But one night, one of the dinner guests refutes this habit and announces that he will only pay for what he has actually consumed. This unexpected decision forces the rest to proceed equally, and as a result, one of the guests does not have enough money to pay the bill. Consequently, what had for years been a group of friends becomes suddenly divided into two sides: those who can pay and those who cannot. These cannots are suddenly considered scroungers who have been taking advantage of the first group. It is important to point out that the book was written in 2003, some years before the effects of the 2008 global crisis, because it warns us that the decline of the welfare system is previous to the financial crisis, although the latter conferred it its most sinister tinges. Of course, this isn't about defending in any sense cadgers, the only way for citizens to pay their taxes with serenity and conviction is that they have the safety that any abuse or fraud will be prosecuted. The veil of ignorance must also, and very specially, affect the ministries of finance. It's about understanding that welfare is not a natural social condition, but the result of certain public policies regarding the fiscal redistribution of income and wealth. The important thing here, in one case or the other, it's the replacing of the image of the agreement for that of the confrontation between the scroungers and the payers. Regarding that point, it is an unimportant matter who we place under the label of scroungers: immigrants, millionaires, politicians, or of payers: businessmen, the underground workers, the uncomplaining citizens. What counts is the replacement of welfare policies for policies of discontent, segregation and discrimination that have as a reference in all the cases identity that of the presumed and mythical majority that supports the Western values or the national essences or the sum of the minorities whose offended identities demand reparation and therefore only shine under antagonism. A false alternative. For a while, the idea has spread that the political expression of this antagonism would take shape, currently, in the apparent confrontation between populist policies, those that guarantee that nobody will receive a bill that cannot be paid, but that, unfortunately, cannot guarantee us that we have food to bring to our table, and the neoliberals, the ones that guarantee us that we will not have to defray some scrounger's expenses, but that, unfortunately, cannot guarantee us that we may ourselves have to become scroungers some day. But under these labels, there is no mention to two political programmes, as it is to a same and paradoxical, emotional and rhetorical load with two heads. In its polemical meaning, the term neoliberalism refers sometimes to Hayek, other times to Friedman, occasionally to Tony Blair, and in some cases to concepts so different as corporatism, protectionism, or the so-called social liberalism, and its only stable feature seems the roughly sketched reference to the politics of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, two leaders that were the first ones to be described in their day as populists. This description has been, for its part, also used so profusely, with such variety and for so many different cases, that it seems due precisely to this overuse to have lost all its conceptual value. Or, in other words, it seems that it had lost all its conceptual value until some of its receivers decided, more or less in the turn of the century, to transform this sign of infamy into a sign of distinction. So to use the terminology of Pierre Bourdieu and give this term a positive meaning. By providing the term neoliberalism with theoretical content, at least apparently, and a new semantic, it is not only changed into a legitimate political instrument, but even the essence of politics itself may be as the only way for politic making to keep up with the times. And this is the subtle sense that makes it more interesting. I normally say that populism is to politics what sensationalism is to journalism. There are probably very few journalists that have not accused their rivals of being sensationalist, but there are even less that have not resorted to sensationalism to embellish sales figures or the number of visits to their webpage. Despite the irony, this does not mean that we must give up to the confusion of journalism and sensationalism, or at the most, to distinguish between good sensationalism, the one put at the disposal of popular, politically correct, or morally irreproachable causes, and bad sensationalism. Regardless of how widespread the disease is, sensationalism is still a disease that makes journalism bleed and move away from public interest, that is, serving as an instrument for the formation of public opinion, which is essential in democratic societies, to merely follow, as someone said, the flow of concern of the public, frequently with the lowest and meanest interests, often contradictory and always changing and opaque, and that have certainly nothing to do with the public interest. Despite all, it is worthwhile to keep the difference, at least the dire difference, between journalism and sensationalism, as even the noblest purposes become corrupt when they are pursued through miserly means that transform information into sentimental propaganda. Something similar happens with populism and with neoliberalism as one of its facets. It is very easy for a politician to discredit their rival as being populist by saying to the people what they want to hear, despite not being true, and promising them things that they know are impossible to achieve. But it would be very difficult to find a politician who, during a campaign, has not resorted sometimes to these messages or promises to obtain a handful of votes or to obtain better results in the surveys. Nevertheless, the solution cannot consist in accepting the confusion between politics and populism as a fatality, resigning oneself to choose between better or worse populists. Although, in an apparently imprecise way, the term populism, as it happened in the past with the term totalitarianism, helps us to understand something, the different political stratagems, which seem separated by great ideological barriers, have in common and to seek that all of them constitute one of the main transversal dangers that stalk representative democracy from the inside. When democracy works well, something that does not happen every day nor in every place, the politician that fosters the base instincts of their followers or that makes implausible promises ends up paying for these excesses in the ballot boxes. There is only one way of getting rid of this punishment. It involves disbelieving political representation and forging the myth of an omnipotent and ruthless enemy that penetrates all the institutions, that perverts conspiratorially all the spaces of liberty and criticism, and that is immune to the formal mechanisms of liberal democracy. And this is precisely the populist formula. When this formula is successful, when it effectively leaves a mark on citizens, the idea that in order to beat this enemy, we need something more than social democracy based on the rule of law, and something better than politics in the modern sense also permeates. And to achieve it is necessary to appeal to the people that must go beyond their constitution to fight against their enemies. The identity, understood as political identity, is always antagonistic and it attacks the pillars of the state under the rule of law. Then politics are replaced by morality, or by moralized politics that demand to close ranks against the enemies of the people, annulling pluralism. And what then takes its toll in the ballot boxes is contradicting the desires of the followers or rejecting promising chimeras. The discontent in today's politics consists specifically in the consideration of an alternative between those supposed extremes, as if they were the terms of a new political confrontation. That we have to accept populism, whose vices we know more than enough thanks to recent politics, to avoid falling into neoliberalism, or that we must resign ourselves with neoliberalism to avoid the populist drift is the populist approach to which we must not give up to. It is this exact approach that repeats only in the discursive sphere, the old justification of communism as the last barrier against fascism, or of fascism as the only obstacle for communism, leaving aside the bet for the social state based on the rule of law, that was able at that time to neutralize both dangers. Populism is not an alternative to neoliberalism, neither is the other way around. Both are symptoms pertaining to the same political decline syndrome, of the breaking of the social contract that has been at its foundation since the appearance of modern society. Something similar to what I have described on the occasion of the founding of the welfare state happened. Mutatis mutandis in Spain in 1978. Those who had been irreconcilable enemies during the Spanish Civil War and the 40 years of Franco's dictatorship, and those who rejected this agreement, especially the extreme left, including the Basque and the Catalonian nationalist left, became electorally irrelevant and, except the minority that kept on with the armed fight, they took cover in the university lecture rooms, the theatres, the newspapers and the art galleries. And it was there that they forged this cultural revolutionary speech, according to which the social state, based on the rule of law born from the Constitution of 1978, was a dream, a spectacle, according to Debord, that actually hid a continuation of Francoism. Those of us who were unlucky enough to know the Francoist Spain know that the identification between Francoism and parliamentary democracy is a historic fabrication of evidence, but when transformed into an ideology, it produces a great emotional yield to those who practice it. This practice reinforces their moral and aesthetic identity, and it even brings them economic benefits. Without this poetic license creating the image that Spain was asleep, first because of the Francoist nightmare, and later by capitalist drowsiness, it would be impossible to consider the 15M as an awakening. But, just as it happened in May 1968 in France, unexpectedly, this political poetry was no longer a minority and became, even electorally, plausible. It mixed up with history And for an important part of the people, the transition to democracy boiled down to a jumble of corruption and conspiracy. It is true that in this case, their logic is much more transparent than in the case of May 1968. It was justified enough with the difficulties caused by the budgetary adjustment with which the public debt crisis was fought for the sake of appearance in 2011, with little difference in a few months of the awakening of the oppressed people and of the abused nation that had been kept, according to this account, in a comatose condition for 70 years through the anaesthesia of the damned welfare. The result of all this has been a fictitious shift of the ideological spectrum, thanks to which, in the imaginary revolutionary awakening, those who, by then, were in the centre-left or the centre-right, but against nationalism and caviar communism, have, without changes, been cornered in a reactionary position. The result is that their positions are even more extreme than that of Trump or Le Pen, because these two are at least anti-system, and gives them an extra dose of authenticity, and extreme ideologies have nevertheless occupied the centre of the political spectrum. I would say that this, rather than an awakening, is an optical political illusion. But I understand that when millions of voters act like they believed in this hallucination, and they join their policies of discontent and confrontation, insisting on a clear differentiation between poetry and history may be a lost battle. These kinds of battles take place very frequently in an intellectual sphere, because the policies of discontent do not triumph because the voters believe in the viability of their positive goals, unearthly and badly defined, but because they want the negative or aggressive means that their propagandists propose, because they want to see their enemies punished. Those enemies, the caste, the immigrant, the enemies of the people, are constructed ad hoc and are considered guilty for all their misfortune. In conclusion, situational losses are not enough to understand why this same sector of the population, which, until yesterday, seemed to identify itself with social democracy based on the rule of law, is now capable of supporting at the ballot boxes political leaders that defend without too many scruples racism, xenophobia, excluding nationalism, providing there is any other kind of nationalism, sexism, and quitting the European Union, free trade agreements or agreements regarding environmental policies. We often ridicule these new leaders, saying that they are clowns, louts or second-class comedians, because many of us cannot accept that they take the things they say seriously. But if they are so ridiculous and undependable, how is it that the same population, which until little time ago seemed sensible and well-balanced regarding their electoral behaviour, let themselves be fooled by lies that we consider so crude? The social discontent caused by the degradation of social welfare structures would have not devolved into political malaise in the sense outlined right now if it had not connected in the first place with a malaise with the welfare state that occurred far before the financial crisis that became already visible when there was full-scale welfare and that, therefore, is not only related to material scarcities and, secondly, with a criticism towards the state based on the rule of law and the fundamentals of the social contract that support liberal democracy and that has even deeper historical and philosophical roots. It has sometimes been upheld, abusing Marx's well-known dictum, that whilst discontent, e.g. the one that appeared already in the 19th century and later on during the times of the two world wars, has a tragic expression, it has in our time the traits of a comedy. I mistrust any philosophy of history, and therefore also this presumed law of political events that says that all the great occurrences appear first as a tragedy and then as a farce, among other things, because it is easy to laugh at Hitler and Stalin and reduce their tragedies to the category of comedies when we do not have to endure their consequences. Ultimately, As history has a tendency to repeat itself, I am skeptical because the farce can easily become a tragedy when the deceitful seize power.